Well, thank you, Alan, and I want to give a special thanks to Bill McClay for the invitation to come out and speak to the Philadelphia Society here in Dallas. There's a lot of people here whose work I've read and whose work I admire, and I also want to thank you guys for your participation in this event. So the talk for that I'm going to give is entitled Upstream from Culture, the Centrality of the Family, which is maybe a little bland, but I'll hope to spice it up a little bit, put some gravy on the potatoes. And I want to start with this question. Can America survive without strong families? Societal decadence is in large part family decadence, the decay of the family. Sure, crime makes decadence. Lack of discipline in the army might mean that there's a decadent society. The quality of a country's leadership might suggest that you have a decadent society. But family decay is the linchpin of society's decay. And sometimes we recognize this, or even are allowed to recognize it. Outward signs of family decadence are rampant. Things like the use of pornography, the easy acceptance of alternative lifestyles, living together outside of marriage, bears, cross-dressing. I'm big, I'm hairy, I'm often mistaken. Parents neglecting their children. These are practically what we mean when we talk about family decadence. But then there are other signs of decay that I guess President Hoover's group noticed, but I would say are worse. People are having many fewer babies. Our birth rate has gone from around 2 15 years ago to just over 1.5 today. Trends suggest that about 25% of women born in 1992, today's 30-year-olds, will never have children. In 1990, two-thirds of Americans in the prime of their life were married. Now that number is 50%. People are marrying much later. In the 1990s, when Bob Bork wrote Slouching Toward Gomorrah, which I think is the most gloomy, doomy title that I've ever heard, of all the gloomy titles, that's the worst. Then, when he wrote that, out-of-wedlock birth rate was around 30% in the country. Now it's 40%. What are we slouching toward now? And this, my friends, is what we call decadence. I'd like to revive that word. Must I go on? Well, let me give you a quick footnote. There's some good news. Decadence has, on some measure, slowed down among those in the higher stratas of the country. But it is accelerating among the lower stratas. That's the bad news. One can see this driving around rural Idaho. One can see this on the mean streets of Chicago. But just a few stats. About 56% of uppers and middles in America in the prime of their life are married, well over half, but it's only 26% among the lower stratas are married. About 50% of the babies in the lower stratas of America are born outside of marriage. Well, that number's about 20% among middle and uppers. We have two Americas, they're divided by marriage formation, but all the numbers are low, and all of them are getting lower. And what is more alarming, perhaps, are political changes that reflect our inability to even talk about this stuff anymore. Family decadence is no longer much of a political football. The parties are not divided on what to do about this decadence because they don't agree on whether it is decadence. None of the recent Democratic Party platforms deal with this problem. Fewer mainstream books are written by liberals on this problem than there were 20 years ago. So the family has become a kind of partisan niche. Republicans have been mouthing mostly the same talking points on this for about two generations, but we'll talk about that in a second. And let's put this into a broader context. Let's think about this in a pretty broad context. Once again, I think this would be a contrast with the Hoover days. Let's put the pornography debate in that broader context. The anti-porn position has lost a lot of ground in three generations. In the late 1950s, the public issue was whether to ban soft core porn literature aimed at adults. My favorite books, like Lady Chatterley's Lover, were banned in New York. And these bans were lifted in the late 50s. We're talking about literature for adults. Then bans on every kind of hardcore porn went away in the 1970s. Then we got internet pornography. And now it is a partisan issue to ban graphic novels aimed at kindergartners with graphic depictions of oral sex and sodomy. Our libraries in Idaho, for instance, are filled with these books, but our conservative legislators are terrified of the issue. Taking action against such libraries are highly controversial, and few are willing to do it. Assume that the ban that was passed in Florida recently holds. Is this a victory? If we consider this a victory, well, what does that say about us? It's very sobering. And it matters. Of course it matters. It matters for social health, and it matters for individual health. This has been the conservative position all along. No society can embrace family decadence and survive. Ill-formed families are associated with all manner of social ill. We are hardly allowed to notice this, but the total breakdown of the urban family has coincided with great crime waves, the lack of school success, gang violence, drug use, poor job prospects, poor habits, poor family formation for the next generation, and a general lack of responsibility. We can notice the same things when they happen in rural America, and we can add suicide to the list of social ills, but we are not allowed to see it as a crisis and to do much about it. Sometimes we deal with the effects of family formation. We will enforce drug laws, for instance, but mostly we just decriminalize drug use so as not to have to deal with those effects. Now, the problems among the upper and middle stratas are less pronounced. We could probably live as a people for a while, at least, if they set the baseline for how Americans lived. This is a way better decadence, I like to say. Our uppers and middles increasingly live like East Asians. Many fewer marriages, many fewer children, but the marriages that there are mostly intact. Think about this. 65% of college-educated women were married in 1990. That number is 50% in 2017, probably headed to 40% now. And most important, this trend continues. East Asia, with its cratering birth rates and marriage rates, may well be our future. So I'm thinking of another book, Slouching Towards Singapore. What is that? But most importantly, this group will not help revive the family norms anywhere in the rest of society. Family formation now seems to presuppose economic success. And economic success is beyond the reach of lots of people in our society. This is decadence, but without the obvious social pathologies. So our situation is decadence, family decadence, as I say. And the question of what we can do about it is connected with a deeper question of why this is happening. And on this question, I think, conservatives should be taking stock at our great defeats over the last two generations. Consider our family policy victories over the past 30 years. In the beginning, there were tax deductions, and they were good. But America's first tax credit came in the early 90s, $500 per child. Now it sits at $2,000 per child. The marriage penalty has lessened, maybe even closed. Now there are fruitful debates about adopting expanded child support programs. These great accomplishments of conservative policy have nevertheless coincided with sharp declines in fertility and family formation and the great problems among the lower income stratas. Why do we continue to invest hopes in such programs? We should honor those who have done the hard work to get these kinds of programs passed, but let us also fairly acknowledge that these reforms were, ultimately, beside the point. And now let us whisper something quite uncomfortable, but I hope it is clarifying. Family decline reflects a change in America's sexual constitution, in the broad ideas that Americans embrace about what is good, advantageous, and just when it comes to the relations between the sexes. Emphasizing economic support to families was a way where family advocates could support the family without really challenging our new sexual constitution, which is made up of feminist and sexual liberationist principles. Feminists mildly opposed economic support policies, but they could acquiesce in those policies without giving up that much. Those economic policies support the family while mostly accommodating the predominant and very aggressive ideologies of sexual liberation and feminism. And the efficacy of the conservative strategy has been greatly overrated. We should admit it. Can we as a people get from the principles of feminism to strong families? Can we as a people get from the principles of sexual liberation to strong families? If the principles of feminism are the predominant ideology, or is among the prominent ideologies of our people, what will families look like? What will families look like if the principles of sexual liberation are our principles? My answer is this. If you want to see what the world of feminism and sexual liberation will look like, look at today's family decline in America and look around the world and then hit the gas pedal. The anti-family nature of feminism and sexual liberation theory are not hidden away in the dark recesses of academic journals. They are sewn into its founding principles. I think it was Irving Berlin asked, if you asked me, I could write a book, and I have written a book on this. But instead of trying to prove what is really beyond dispute, I want to focus on what the success of these ideologies means for those who want to pursue an effective family policy in the future. Let us reflect on conservative failures and on feminist and sexual liberationist successes to plot a roadmap for an effective family policy in the future. Let's talk first about the feminist successes. The feminist successes have been the great political success of a high order over the last generations. Feminists have fundamentally transformed public opinion in their direction, such that what we see is different from what we used to see. But the feminist success is not exactly what they had thought it would be. Feminists seek a world beyond gender, in Judith Butler's words. The world has three pillars, I would submit. First, the differences between men and women evaporate, and socialization toward distinct gender roles would be prohibited in a society. Their second goal for feminists is seek a society in which women achieve emotional and economic independence from domestic duties and from family life. In the pursuit of female independence, they adopt the third pillar of feminist thought, which is the end of sexual taboos. Sexual taboos, they say, promote enduring monogamous marriage and enslave women to the family. These three pillars of feminism, independence, androgyny, and the end of sexual taboos, are really sewn into America's political culture now, into its sexual constitution now. But we have not gotten the world that the feminists have promised, not by a long shot. Critics of feminism, and this, by this I mean conservatives mostly, were right to suggest that all these goals were inhuman and against human nature. All people are dependent, so the aspiration for independence runs against our nature. Men and women are inherently different, so the demand for androgyny is against human nature. Sexual modesty, among other things, is impossible to overcome amongst most people, so that demand is against human nature too. There will always be some sexual taboos. And conservatives have long thought that we have done something when we point out the problems of feminism. Usually we trot out quotations, probably from Horace, to the effect that you can chase nature out with a pitchfork, but she always comes running back in. And we have done something when we show that these theories are insufficient. The problem is we haven't done enough. Conservatives and family activists have been standing athwart the sexual revolution, shouting nature for decades, to little effect. Nature imposes limits, but nature's limits are not self-enforcing, and they do not point directly to family life. males and females act and think differently from one another under our new sexual constitution, in a rebuke to the androgynous hopes of feminists. A supermajority continues to desire old-fashioned discipline of monogamy and marriage, in a rebuke to those who hope to get rid of sexual taboos. But the persistence of nature has not portended a return to norms supporting marriage and family life. Instead, what we get is a new sexual constitution that cultivates a new kind of man and a new kind of woman. And neither the new man or the new woman is much suited to marriage or very willing to prioritize marriage in their lives. And this is the bottom line, right? Feminism and the sexual revolutionaries promised liberation, but there is no liberation. Conservatives have always been right about that. We only get different chains. They have given us new gender scripts instead of no gender scripts. A new idea of what a good woman and a good man is what we've gotten from feminism. We've gotten a new system of honor and shame. They shape public opinion toward their ideal. And it is just that ideal is much less interested in preparing people for marriage and family life. Let me illustrate this with the most obvious and universal example, having babies. Independence from the family is best accomplished if women do never become mothers and never have babies. This may mean that they do not perform the duties of mother, or it may mean that they forego having children altogether. Yet nature screams to women, have babies. Their bodies seem to be made for it. Conservatives may have hoped that the problem would kind of solve itself. How many of us have said this about ourselves and our daughters? Feminism says, do not have kids. The body says, have kids, and nature will win out in the end. But this is obviously not the case. There needs to be public support for the decision to have children. Public honor has to be attached to having children. Nature needs to be encouraged through a welcoming culture. Women can do lots of things in their lives. Why have children instead of trying to make partner in a law firm or teaching gender studies? Why have children instead of becoming a nun? Why take care of the children when a nanny can? Why not farm the job of raising children out to experts like kindergarten teachers and daycare professionals? There's another example of this. It's kind of stunning to have to say it, but I'm going to say it. Sexual attraction is also culturally mediated and can be attenuated in some circumstances. In Japan and South Korea, for instance, we could talk about our hotel for the weekend, but I'll use Japan and South Korea to make this a little more antiseptic. Polls indicate that people have less sex and marriage rates have fallen off the cliff. Birth rates are under one in most of these countries. Manners and mores are needed to encourage men and women to actually dance the sexual dance. We would never have thought that. Sexual attraction seems so natural, but it's also culturally encouraged and discouraged. We used to think that sex provided the grist for love, but both can lessen to almost nothing in society. So the two most basic human so-called instincts are partly constructed by society. In noticing this, we must give a nod to the philosophy undergirding feminism. Feminists thought society constructed nearly everything, and we need to give an inch here. Society constructs things out of the materials provided by nature. Give the feminists more than an inch, however, and they will take the whole mile. So culture finishes nature. Culture shapes nature. Culture uses nature to build as the materials out of which it is built. Nature alone needs the help of culture. This means that family advocates have to get into the business of constructing a sound, family-friendly notion of gender. We must work with the grains of nature to construct sounder and more attractive notions of gender than feminism does. We might call this sex role realism. Perhaps we always knew this, but we've been afraid to say it with our full throats. It is not a question of making time or making sure there are sufficient resources. Those are issues and important issues, but they are second issues. The family policy question is this: how to get people to prioritize enduring relations, deeply communal and serious family life when they have so many other options? What do we want out of women? What do we want out of men? Those have to be our guiding questions, not embarrassed to ask them, but like front and center. And when one answers these questions, one treads obviously on very controversial grounds. Trust me, I know. But we nevertheless must reason together. And this is what I call the sexual counter-revolution. The goals of the sexual counter-revolution are these. We must establish systems of honor and shame, pass laws and buttress institutions that shape the natural inclinations of men and women in more humane and fruitful ways than does this feminist constitution shaped by feminism and the sexual revolutionaries. That is our goal. What do we want from men? Answer: responsibility and provision, sexual self-mastery, and the ability to interest women and provide for them in a family, making demands on children when they are parents, or I should say fathers. What do we want from women? Making motherhood a priority in her life while mixing in work as needed and desired. Honoring an honorable man. Prioritizing nurturing and being the hub of a community. There's nothing more incredible than giving birth to a child. We should say that. And let us see it as a wonder, just as Eve did. Moreover, the closer sex can be brought to the domain of marriage, the better. Perhaps America could begin celebrating big families again as well. This would be very difficult since our leadership class and opinion leaders are people with uncommonly small families. Obviously, motherhood first will not be what every woman does. Obviously, women can do things other than be mothers. But my guess, based on the assessment of the evidence, is that this is the heart's desire. To be a mother is the heart's desire of about 3/4 of American women, and in fact, women around the world. Men would have to mature faster and better to meet their needs. Those norms, however, are needful for a society-wide rebirth of marriage and family life. There are certainly policies that we could adopt to support this vision. We could emphasize part-time work for women. Divorce laws with different default rules might encourage sobering second thoughts, especially from women who file about 70% of divorces. We could embrace sex-segregated education for longer in primary schools. Thorough parental choice in education, not to encourage competition or excellence, but to cultivate and reinforce a sense of parental responsibility, could be adopted. Laws should be based on sex role realism, not the inhumane demands of androgyny from the feminists. When we see disparities in career choices between men and women, we need not panic. They express and reflect sex role realism. For too long, family advocates have accommodated these ideologies or considered them to be unchangeable features of our political community. If they are, we are probably doomed, to quote another doomy, gloomy book. So it is time to liberate our inner Phyllis Schlafly's of blessed memory and oppose feminism again. This means starting small, probably starting with ourselves, but we must ultimately take that ambition national. Thank you.